From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack, alongside host Evan Dawson.
Hello, Megan Mack.
Hello. This is a fast-moving look at what we've discussed on Connections this week, and we'll start with a subject that always sparks a passionate response: charter schools.
Yeah, the Democrat and Chronicle ran a cover story about charter schools and how they're funded, how they're managed. That piece raised questions about transparency, among other things. So we welcome to the program Jeff Rosenberger, the board chair for a group of five local charter schools, along with Shoggy Tell, an education professor at Nazareth College who generally opposes charter schools.
First, you'll hear Jeff Rosenberger explaining that despite the DNC report and despite what some critics claim, charter schools are public schools, not private.
They are public schools. They're not privately run. They're run by boards of trustees, but those boards of trustees have to be approved by the chartering entity, either SUNY or the Board of Regents. The students take the same exams as district schools take. The board meetings are all subject to open meeting law, the New York State open meeting law, as are district schools. The reports that charter schools have to file with the state education department are voluminous. So it's not like Harley or Allendale or McQuaid or Aquinas, where they're private entities and they can pretty much operate their schools the way they want. The rules around charter schools are extensive and rigid, and these are public schools in every sense of the word. They're just not district schools.
Let me ask Shoggy Tell about a comment he made in the piece that I thought was one of the strongest comments in the piece, which was this. Here's the quote in Justin's piece. As long as any public service is put under private authority, it can't really serve the public in any meaning of the word, said Shoggy Tell, an education professor at Nazareth College and a vocal critic of charter schools. It can't serve the public in any meaningful way?
So actually, that wasn't, Justin, that wasn't a super exact quote, but we can take the essence of it.
Would you stand by those words?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And let me explain. So one of the things, I've been researching charter schools for about 8 or 9 years, and one of the things I've noticed is that there is extreme confusion on the topic. One of the confusions that comes up repeatedly is this public-private distinction. And what's been happening since the late 70s, early 80s, is that this division between the public and the private has been deliberately blurred. And it's part of what's called the neoliberal program, the neoliberal agenda. And it manifests itself in what's called public-private partnerships, or the outright direct privatization of a range of public services.
But why deliberately blur it?
Deliberately blur it because in the context of a failing economy where major owners of capital are under intense pressure to maximize profits and there's no good place to get investments and a reasonable return on investments, then you have to go into the nonprofit sector, the public sector, where there's large pools of public funds, and basically set up pay-the-rich schemes or these kinds of arrangements that end up transferring and funneling huge sums of public funds, public assets, public facilities to private entities, all under the veneer of high ideals.
Let me get back to Jeff Rosenberger for a response. Again, he's the board chair of Rochester Prep. That's a group of five charter schools in Rochester. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, your assumption, you know, you're making the statement that these are being done for profit. All the charter schools operating in Rochester today are not for profit, and the charter management organizations that operate in Rochester today are not for profit. So who's benefiting from this supposed profit grab?
Well, but Jeff, a not-for-profit banner doesn't mean much. I mean, the NFL is not-for-profit, you know, and its commissioner is making a lot of money. There's a lot of people making a lot of money. So I don't think that banner is ipso facto evidence that there is not potential for profit. But I also think it's fair to ask Shoggy Tell, you don't think anybody in the business community who's investing in charter schools or investing their time, you don't think they're doing it for truly magnanimous reasons?
That's not the main question. For me, the main question is, as an educational arrangement, what do charter schools represent in the United States? The question of people's intentions, I don't really get into because I don't know people's intentions. But I know the results and the effects of different policies and arrangements. And so we know from work done at the National Education Policy Center that right now, a little more than 44% of charter school students are enrolled in private for-profit schools, charter schools. And that the comment that most charter schools are nonprofit, that may be true, but it's also true, as Justin pointed out in his article, and so many others have done the same, is that these private nonprofit entities actually engage in all kinds of outsourcing and contracting and for-profit arrangements with what's called secondary providers.
You can look for more discussions of charter schools in the months to come on Connections. Next, let's turn to a question of ethics.
Yeah, it's been kind of a bad few weeks for Monroe County government, with several people pleading guilty to felony bid rigging charges, including the husband of former county executive Maggie Brooks. The new county executive, Cheryl Donolfo, is proposing a brand new county ethics office. Its job would be to investigate possible corruption and prevent scandal.
The county executive's proposal would give her the authority to hire and fire the director of this new office, and Democrats have a problem with that.
Yeah, we spoke to former Rochester Police Chief Jim Shepard, who's now a Democrat on the county legislature. He wants this new office to be independent, not pressured to please county bosses.
There's an association of inspector generals which outlines, you know, what a integrity office should look like and the accountability and the independence that it should have. And, you know, one of the things that we've talked about is the fact that going back 4 or 5 years, if we already had an integrity office in the county, would that person feel comfortable going to the county exec to say, we believe that your husband is involved in activities that may not be ethical? And so that's the thinking, is that if you go with the standards, nobody can challenge you down the road based on how you built your office. What I'm advocating for is that, you know, this is a defining moment for the county exec, a defining moment for the Monroe County Legislature, for us to put something in place that shows that based on what has occurred, that we're going to do something that will truly make a difference.
County lawmakers will vote on a new ethics office in March. Now let's turn to the saddest story of the week, a conversation about mental health following a double murder-suicide in Geneseo.
You probably know the story by now. A Geneseo student named Kelsey Anisi had been dating 24-year-old Colin Kingston for 3 years. She broke up with him. Friends say he was distraught, and according to police, he went to Kelsey's house in the early morning hours last month, went inside, found her with another man, and murdered them both before killing himself.
We asked our panel to discuss what a healthy relationship is and what isn't. You'll hear from Pamela Graham, the Prevention Education and Training Coordinator with Willow Domestic Violence Center of Rochester. But first, you'll hear psychiatrist Dr. Michael Scharf of UR Medicine.
And here, Dr. Scharf is responding to a question about the Geneseo murders. I asked him about the various writers who have said that we should not say that men kill out of love or out of a broken heart.
As we focus on such a tragedy, the reality is people do have breakups, and there are not reactions like this a lot of the time. I would restate the point I made, that people's background of how they deal with adversity, how they deal with conflict, is violence something that's been role modeled in their life, and it's a way they've dealt with conflict before. Those are the kind of things that you could see in advance or contribute to how one reacts with a new breakup. And when we're talking about people who are younger, you referred to high schools, and for many even in college, it's often their first relationship. So even though they might go on to have a life of many breakups, the first one is always different.
We're under the fallacy that people break up from dangerous relationships, and they don't. See, people who are abusive don't leave. They don't go away. So people who are surviving dating domestic violence situations, they don't break up. They escape. We break up from unhealthy ones, and it takes us 6 months to a year, maybe longer, to heal from that. But everybody does, because, Evan, like you said in the article, it said if breaking up was the reason why people got killed, college campuses would be empty. Well, the world would be barren, yeah, because it happens to all of us. So, but what we know about dangerous relationships is once they start, the more they happen, the worse they get. They don't start until there's a commitment. So survivors know what they got. They're just not trusting us to tell us. And not only that, the people that they trust so much turned out to be a nightmare. So it's subtle. Once it starts, the more it happens, the worse it gets. It ends at physical abuse. It does not start there. But that's when we all start paying attention. So the verbal abuse, the emotional abuse. I mean, abusers gain the power and control by the first threat. I love you so much, I don't know what I'd do without you. I can't have you, nobody else is. That's a game changer for every survivor, that they know they're no longer in healthy, but in a dangerous one.
You mean once that's actually articulated?
Yes, and they might be subtle. So that might be once there's a commitment, once the threats start, the more they happen, the worse they get. So an abuser gains the power and control with the threats. they follow through with the power and control by maintaining those threats. And that instills enough fear in every survivor that they know it, they're in over their head. So we have to be in a place that, first off, that they can trust us and that we're not going to disclose anything to the world that will make them in greater danger.
You can find more on how to help people escape dangerous relationships at willowcenterny.org. Now let's turn to a program that is helping kids stay connected to their parents when their parents go to prison. It's called the Storybook Program at the Ontario County Jail.
More than half the adults incarcerated in our country have young children. In 1980, 1 in 125 American kids had a parent in jail or prison. But today, it's 1 in 28. That is almost one child on average in every American classroom with a parent in prison.
So Storybook is a program in which the parent records their own voice reading a book to their child. Then the child receives a package in the mail. It includes the book, the audio recording, and a note from mom or dad.
Filmmaker Linda Maroney has created a documentary called Turn the Page, and it debuts next Thursday night at the Little Theater. She joined us on Connections, and here she is talking about why she wanted to make this film.
It seems such an amazing story. I had no idea, you know, and I knew nothing about children of incarcerated parents and what goes on there. So I read to my kids every night. It's a really, really special and sacred time. And, you know, I thought if I drove home from a party one night and had too much to drink and got into a car accident, I could be in the jail and it would be me. And I would have to give up that bedtime story. And I don't know that Storybook can fix everything, but I think it's a really, really great and important tool to have in the kit to build that so that the chances are better and it's higher chance for success down the road.
Let's listen to a man named David Seeley in the film about why read to kids. He had a daughter and a stepson when he was incarcerated. And this is from Turn the Page. This is David Seeley.
You know, your body may be locked up and inside a correctional facility, but they can't lock your mind, heart, and soul up. As long as you can stay focused, not let negative thoughts get to you, and as long as you can be positive and keep moving forward, it may not seem like it, but you're helping your child. So remember, Ben, you can always do what you set your mind to. Always stay positive and be good for your mom. I love you, buddy. Love, David.
Storybook shows at the Little Theater on Thursday night at 7:30. Now we turn to a sad chapter in American history, and it's one that many of us have never heard before.
The story of Ota Benga. In 1906, the Bronx Zoo opened a new display in its monkey house. There, next to the monkeys, the orangutans, the chimpanzees, there in a steel cage was a man, an African man named Ota Benga from Congo. He had been kidnapped, brought back to New York, and placed in a cage as a public spectacle. And some scientists mused that this might be evidence of the missing link between species.
For decades, the story was essentially covered up. But journalist Pamela Newkirk uncovered the truth and wrote the story in a book called Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Ota Benga. The book was one of 25 selected by NPR as one of its must-reads for 2015. And Newkirk visited Connections this week.
It was the Bronx Zoo, this nation's most famous zoo at that time and now. And it was presented as science. It was presented as something that during the progressive era, at the dawn of the 20th century, that scientists signed off on. You know, scientists, one of the trustees at the Bronx Zoo at the time was one of the most eminent scientists in this country, Henry Fairfield Osborne, one of the co-founders of the zoo. He thought it was a good idea. Madison Grant Hornaday, who was the founding director of the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., again, an eminent man of science.
These weren't marginalized people with obviously racist views. They're mainstream leaders.
Mainstream. And so it matters because it's important that we see our heritage, right? That we're able to connect the dots from where we were 100 years ago to where we are and the resonance of some of these ideas that were so deeply embedded and the bedrock of, you know, in science, history. I mean, if you looked at an encyclopedia in 1906, if you looked up African, he was described in a Webster's collection as midway between an orangutan and a human being.
To find out what happened to Otubenga during his captivity at the zoo and afterward, we urge you to read Pamela Newkirk's book.
All right, let's end the week with a little music.
We need that. The world of pop music has lost some big names and voices recently.
Yeah, David Bowie, Glenn Frey, Maurice White, among others, just this year.
We welcome John Kovach, the director of the Institute of Popular Music at the University of Rochester. John seems to know everything about the people involved in pop music, so we talked about Bowie, Frey, and White.
I have to say I may be a little bit partial toward Glenn Frey because he grew up about 10 miles from me in Royal Oak and I was living in Livonia. He got his start working with Bob Seger. If you know the Bob Seger song, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man, that high harmony in the chorus, that's Glenn Frey back there. You know, Bob Seger played a big role in helping Glenn to sort of develop his songwriting skills. I just think, this hipsterism that you get among critics where they just want to scorn anything that seems like it has any kind of popular appeal, as if any artist, aspires to be unpopular or unloved because they're going to win some kind of a credential with the hipsters. That's just not what popular music is. Couldn't a guy have done something in his 20s that was new and different and then decided to become just a really first-class entertainer and songwriter and do it really well? That's, I think, Glenn Frey did. Too bad if it doesn't fit in with somebody's idea with what's hip when they're hanging out at the coffee bar.
All right, well, let's get John's feeling on what I think is the best mood song I think I've ever heard, and a man who we just lost with Earth, Wind, and Fire. And I know this is at every wedding you've ever heard, but how do you not get in a good mood when you hear this? I started to see Val dance a little bit back there, our engineer. I saw it. Yes, I did. Maurice White passing away at the age of 74, complications with Parkinson's disease. Right. So we lost him 2 days ago. Where do they rank for you, John?
Well, I think that when we think about Earth, Wind, and Fire, it's only fair to say that there is a parallel history to rock and roll, which would be the history of black pop, especially since 1945. And in the history of black pop, Earth, Wind, and Fire have got to be the Eagles of the 70s. As big as the Eagles were is as big as Earth, Wind, and Fire was. And you can see all of this, the stuff in that group coming out of not only sort of Motown and the Stax Horns and a lot of what was happening with Philly Soul and all that. It was just a fantastic culmination of a lot of what had been brewing in black pop going all the way back to the 50s. And of course, again, like I say about all these guys, we were talking about Glenn Frey, fantastic songwriting. You got to have a song with a hook or people can admire you, but they won't buy it.
I was just thinking the same. In fact, I was thinking, and you're the director of the Institute for Popular Music. I'm just the amateur who's observing here, but I'm thinking the vocals at Earth, Wind, and Fire, remarkable vocals, and the production quality is outstanding. There's a lot of layers there.
There's a lot of parallels between this group and the Eagles. First of all, in the Eagles, find a guy that can't sing in that band. And when they sing live, there's no pitch correction. Boy, they're just nailing those
harmonies.
It's
tight, isn't
it? It's fantastic. And the same thing with Earth, Wind, and Fire. Just fantastic. And those Earth, Wind, and Fire horns. Of course, maybe Tower of Power was really the group in the 70s that had the reputation for having just the best kind of horn section. Among white groups, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, or Chicago, had a similar kind of a approach, but the approach of Earth, Wind, and Fire really was to be the leading group in the mid-70s in a kind of black R&B or black pop kind of sound.
All right, is everyone feeling a little better now listening to a little Earth, Wind, and Fire?
I hope so. Thanks for listening to Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can find every full hour of Connections in podcast form as well. Just go to wxxinews.org/connections.
And here's our music. Hey, there it is. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon, 12 to 2 on WXXI Radio, on WEOS 89.5 FM in the Finger Lakes, WRUR FM Rochester, and of course, on the WXXI mobile app and on wxxi.org/listen. Have a wonderful weekend. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you on Monday.